Empower yourself today with legal knowledge and follow us on Instagram, Twitter, or Facebook to get access to jargon-free legal information in plain and simple English. Today's episode is supported by Red Bar Law, the go-to law firm for expert, efficient, and fast legal assistance, all at a fixed cost. Go to our website at redbarlaw.com. Empower yourself today and follow us on TikTok, Instagram, Facebook, YouTube, and LinkedIn by searching Get Legally Speaking to get access to jargon-free legal information in plain and simple English. Today's episode is supported by Red Bar Law, the go-to law firm for expert, efficient, and fast legal assistance, all at a fixed cost. Go to our website at redbarlaw.com. With over 3 million downloads and counting, do not miss out on learning more about a topic that interests you. Go over to our website at getlegallyspeaking.com and browse over 100 podcast episodes. Empower yourself today with legal knowledge and follow us on Instagram, Twitter, or Facebook to get access to jargon-free legal information in plain and simple English. Today's episode is supported by Red Bar Law, the go-to law firm for expert, efficient, and fast legal assistance, all at a fixed cost. Go to our website at redbarlaw.com. Our episodes are free to access. However, if you feel that you would like to support the children's charity that we are raising money for, then head over to our Just Giving page at justgiving.com and search for Hattie Savari, where we are raising money for orphaned children at SOS Children's Villages, one of the worthiest children's charities. Donate as little as £1 for a great cause. Thank you. Hello and welcome to our podcast at Get Legally Speaking. Our legal conversation today will be about myths in criminal law, understanding common perceptions, part two. Please do listen to our part one podcast. I am joined today by senior barrister, Mr. John Riley from 23 Essex Street Chambers in London. John specialises in serious criminal cases and he is an expert and a leader in this field. His expertise in these areas has led him to representing the Criminal Bar Association for many years on shaping policy and legislative direction on the new demands of complex cases in these challenging areas of law. He regularly writes and speaks on his areas of expertise and he has been acknowledged in a number of leading publications. John is also an elected councillor in a London borough. Thank you ever so much for joining me again, John.
Absolute pleasure, Hattie. Nice to see you again.
It's lovely to see you, albeit on a screen. You know, it's all good. I was complimenting your glasses earlier and you told me you're a big fan of having some different types of glasses. So there you go. Okay, so myths in criminal law part two and then understanding common misconceptions. I'm going to start with one which popped to my head, I have to say, when I was thinking about this area of law. And it is, do the police have to read my rights if I'm arrested? And I'm taking this question from probably the majority of American films that I've watched. So where do we go with that? Where do we stand with that?
Well, you're absolutely right. I think a lot of people will get some of their legal knowledge from TV and films and so forth. And the assumption is that the usual sort of situation on a TV or film show where the usually American police sort of grab somebody and then immediately start reading them their rights, which is a thing called the Miranda rights. The difference between this country and America is that America have a written constitution and the police are told that they have to do certain things. And if they don't, that has very serious consequences for the whole case later on. But in this country, the reality is that our rights are gathered together from a collection of places, from case law that the judges will have set down, from statute law, from different areas. So the answer in this country is, broadly speaking, yes, the police do have to tell you that you are being arrested and why. But of course, the trouble is that with lots of rules in the legal system in this country, there are many exceptions. So if a police officer does not do that because of the circumstances, maybe there's a fight going on, or maybe it's too difficult, or maybe they're on their own and there's a big crowd gathering or something like that, and they tell you later, then the courts will not, as it were, punish the police or the prosecution for you not being told your rights immediately. But the general rule is that if the police have reasonable grounds to suspect that you've committed an offence and they choose to arrest you, then they do have to tell you that you're being arrested at that time, and they have to caution you, which we'll come on to in a little while, about that action. And that's all governed under a thing called the Police and Criminal Evidence Act way back in 1984, which was the first time really that these sorts of rights were consolidated and put into the same place. There have been lots of other laws in the past about how that should happen, but that was the first time really that there was any attempt to put that all together and to tell the police how they should act in certain circumstances. And with that law, there were a number of what they call codes of practice for the police, which again told them how to behave in certain situations. So, for example, how to conduct identification parades, how they were allowed to enter people's property, how they were able to stop and search. So all those sorts of common activities by the police in combating crime were set out in codes of practice as to how they should behave.
Excellent. So, you know, basically we're saying if your rights have not been read out to you at the time that you're arrested, it's not literally going to be that they've done something wrong, because it could be that once they get you into a vehicle or a contained environment or back to the police station, they can actually do it there as well. Which is very interesting, because, again, I thought that you had to automatically be read your rights on upon being arrested. But you don't think of that, do you? You don't think, well, the situation might not, as you've outlined, it could be that there's crowds coming around. You could be, you're a police officer on your own, and the situation can dictate whether you're able to do it or not, you know. So I didn't actually even think of that way.
I think a lot of the answers to these types of questions are going to be, broadly speaking, yes, you're correct. This is the way it should be. But there are, in this country, there are quite a lot of different qualifications. And as I say, if the police in America, for example, breach the various procedures that they have to go through, then later on that can mean the end of the case. But in this country, yes, barristers will. And solicitors in different courts will raise issues about whether the police have done what they should have done. But the question as to whether or not that is so prejudicial that it should affect all of the evidence in the case, in other words, should the case be allowed to carry on?
Like in America, they can drop cases, as you say.
That is a far more different question as far as the court are concerned. And in some cases, and it used to be quite regularly dealt with, that barristers would object to the way the police have behaved. And a judge might say, well, yes, you're absolutely right. However, what has been the knock-on prejudicial effect to the actual evidence? Now, sometimes, relatively, perhaps rarely, it may have a very devastating consequence on the evidence, and that evidence will go. But more often than not, it will take a very significant failure on the part of the police before evidence and indeed a whole case would be kicked out.
Yes, because we're talking about reading somebody's rights here. Yeah. That's what we're talking about, aren't we? We're not talking about anything more and beyond that. Of course, that's important, and it's important for people that are being arrested to absolutely know their rights. But yeah. I don't think, you know, logic tells me that if you haven't been read your rights at the point that you're being arrested, then your whole case should be allowed to be dismissed in court. And the reason why the police are arresting you for that should be dismissed as a matter of the protocol being that, you know, the procedure that your rights were not physically read out to you. We're not talking about being arrested in a way and handled in a way which is completely wrong and shouldn't happen. We're just talking about somebody having their rights read out to them. So, yeah, I would say, you know, I don't see, unless it's really, really had a big effect on the case itself, why somebody being read out their rights upon being arrested should result in a case being thrown out. I get it. So if somebody's been arrested, and then this is another common saying, isn't it? The right to remain silent. Now, the big question here that I've seen is that people feel sometimes that if they remain silent, it's almost an admission of guilt. And then you no doubt get people that are afraid of saying anything in case they can't interpret what they're trying to say in the correct way, and then it's used against them.
Yeah, that's right. So the real answer is yes, of course, a person has a right to remain silent, and that is enshrined in law. However, it's a I would say that it is a qualified right. You see, when someone is arrested and cautioned by a police officer, the words of the caution are quite interesting. It's that they say you do not have to say anything, but it may harm your defence if you do not mention when questioned something you later rely on in court. Anything you do say may be given in evidence.
Well, that's a bit contradictory, wouldn't you say?
Absolutely, I'd say it was contradictory. But it is designed in that way. And over the years, different versions of the caution have been developed. And this is the one that we've got now and have had for some time. So that's why I say that the real answer to this question is, yes, you do have that right. However, how it will be interpreted in a qualified sense is really what is really the kind of sting in the tail. And the reason for that is that there are two stages, essentially, when you might be expected to say something. First is when you are first arrested and first challenged with whatever it is the police think you've done. And you are given that caution at that stage. And then the police will wait and see if you say anything. The second time is when you are taken to the police station and interviewed, and you are cautioned for a second time and told that you do not have to say anything, but it may harm your defence if you don't mention when questioned. And then they ask you questions. Now, people have a right to answer questions in interview with the police or not. And very often they will be advised by their solicitor at the police station not to say anything, because at that stage, perhaps the police haven't got very much evidence, or the solicitor doesn't know what evidence they've got and they can't make a good assessment, so forth like that. Or maybe, perhaps, the solicitor takes the view that the answers the person's going to give are not going to be terribly helpful to them.
Could work against them in the...
That's right. Until such time as they have seen the whole of the evidence. So, and of course, there are consequences that have been developed over the years for failure to answer questions or failure to say anything. And it very much depends on the circumstances of the case, the circumstances of the individual, as to whether or not in court later, if that's where the case ends up, that any adverse inference can be drawn. In other words, an inference against the person who is arrested and brought before the court, whether any adverse inference can be drawn against that person because they failed to say anything. And the range of circumstances are very wide, and we can't really go into all of them now. But there are different sets of circumstances in which the judge will say to the jury, OK, this person was challenged in this way by the police. I don't know, maybe they're actually sitting in a stolen car, let's say. And it's put to them that they're in a stolen car, and they are asked about what they're doing in the stolen car, and they don't say anything about it. And the judge might say to the jury, well, look, you might expect them to be able to say something about this. You know, I was forced into the car, or I don't know whose car it is, or I'm not the driver, or somebody sold it to me earlier on today.
Right.
All those sorts of things. And it will then be up to the jury, not that they have to hold it against that person, but they can do, given the circumstances.
I mean, you just have this view, don't you, that if someone's being questioned and they're not answering or they're refusing to answer, call it sort of just the way we deal with things in the human mind, you automatically think, well, that they're guilty. That's when they're not saying anything. And if you're saying a jury has to sit there and make that decision, I mean, obviously we're not being specific here in terms of a case, because it could be that person had a very good reason not to say anything aside from, being nervous about saying anything that could be used against them or anything else. But you do have that view that, there is some aspect of somebody being guilty. But as for the actual right to remain silent. Yes, I think, you know, you've answered that great. You have the right to remain silent, but it's just the what happens after that that can affect, and particularly in the actual paragraph that you read out to us, where if you don't say anything when asked, basically, in short terms, that could also be held against you. So it's a bit of a bit mixed bag, that one. But yes, the right remains there. Okay, let's move on to the next one, John. So this question is interesting, and it's about somebody who's got a clean record, no previous convictions. Does it mean that if they're arrested and taken to court for an offence, it will be easier to secure their acquittal, i.e. to be found not guilty because they have no criminal past? Does the court take that into consideration? And obviously I'm not outlining a specific deed that's been done here, but how does the court react to people when in front of them for the first time with a clean record?
Well, of course, we all start with a clean record, and therefore it can't be an absolute defence having a clean record. Otherwise, nobody would ever get convicted.
Indeed.
but yes, I mean, it is an advantage if a person has a clean record and comes before the court for the first time with no previous convictions recorded against them. That doesn't necessarily mean that because they have previous convictions, it will count. It will definitely count against them, but that's a different, slightly different question. What it means is that a person's good character, as we call it, which is not having any past previous convictions, a person's good character counts in their favour, and the judge would normally, in any case where a person of good character comes before the court charged with any offence, the judge would normally almost invariably give what we call a good character direction during the course of the judge's summing up, which is the bit where the judge tells the jury all about the case and about the law at the end of the case. And that good character direction essentially is split into two. It says that the jury may think that because of the person's good character that they are less likely to have committed the offence because they've never done such a thing in the past. And it also goes to their credit as to the extent of their truthfulness that the jury can take into account if that person has then given evidence in court about in their own defence. So it is a powerful thing to have a good character. But as I say, it can't, and the judge will say this as part of this direction, this good character direction. The judge will say, obviously, it cannot be a complete defence to any offence because we all start with a good character, and it very much depends on how the jury see the evidence unfolding before that person. But it is of advantage to a person to have a good character. It also helps, again, with regard to questioning by police, going back to our second question, because of course if you've never been in trouble before and you've never been in a police station and you don't know what the system's all about, and you're not expected to sort of already have a view or a knowledge of what it's about, you can, as a barrister defending someone, you can properly say to the jury, look, it's hardly surprising that they didn't say anything in interview, because the whirlwind of being arrested and cautioned, yes, and taken to the police station.
And it could be that there was a very distressing situation going on while, you know, human behaviour, you know, if you're in shock about something, you're distressed about something, and you decide, I'm not going to say anything because, you know, the incident has had an impact, you know.
Is to say to yourself, when you're sitting there listening to all this accusation coming at you in the interview, you might say, well, hang on, I haven't seen any evidence. It's a very early stage in the process. I don't know whether what you're saying is backed up by evidence from somebody else or by forensic evidence or by medical evidence. So I don't have to say anything. I don't know precisely what's being said against me. Therefore, I'm going to wait until such time as I see
and
the
evidence. That's a really important point, John. You know, that's a really key point, I think, because, you know, if you're arrested and you're taken into a police cell, you're left there for the amount of time that you're left there for, and then you're brought in for questioning, because obviously the police have to decide whether they're going to charge you with what they believe you potentially have done wrong or not. And it's very true. You haven't seen any evidence at that point, actually, have you, really? Unless it's something, God forbid, you just bash someone over the head and they've arrested you there, and that's the incident that's taken place. But with something that hasn't, you haven't seen the evidence for, how could you possibly comment on the case as a whole against you, other than the questioning of the police and trying to give the answers to the police about that?
Well, it very much I'm sorry that it's always a bit like this, but it very much depends. I mean, sometimes, you see, the police obviously will be given some information and they have to act very quickly.
Yes.
On other occasions, they might not arrest somebody until they have brought all the evidence together. But even at the stage of questioning, which is usually very early on, what the police do have to do is to give the solicitor or the legal representative for the person who's being questioned an outline. They call it disclosure, police disclosure, an outline of the allegations being made against them, if they can. I mean, there are some circumstances where they don't. That's quite rare. But generally speaking, they will have some idea, but not, as I say, the full evidence, not often in detail. So what you can do as a defence barrister looking at representing somebody in court is to make the point to the jury, well, what the person didn't know is important. And therefore, if they didn't know and wanted to know what the actual evidence was against them, maybe you might think, members of the jury, that's good reason not to say anything. And you can put it in those terms, because those are the sort of terms which members of the public who make up the jury, I think would very well understand.
No, I get it. Yeah. Well, we've got time for one more area of discussion, and I think this is really key. Clearly there's going to be a part 3, 4, 5, and 6 of this podcast, John. Absolutely. Too much to discuss. So as a trial, if somebody says, I do not want to give evidence, and we're not going to go into the reasons of why they may not want to give evidence, no. But if they say, I do not want to give evidence, do you think the jury will automatically assume that they've got something to hide and therefore, you know, they should be convicted? Again, you know, what's your experience of situations like that?
Well, again, this is governed by rules in court, by the evidential rules in court, and by what the judge will say to the jury or say to a defendant as time is going on through the case. So when the prosecution case is finished, that is the time when it's the turn for the defence case to start. And more often than not, the judge will say to the defence counsel or defence solicitor, is your client going to give evidence? And a decision will have been made at some point by the defence team with the defendant, with the client, with the person accused, as to whether or not he or she wants to give evidence. Now, some people are absolutely adamant and they want to have their day in court and they want to say what happened to them, and they will absolutely want to give evidence. And then they go into the witness box and they are questioned, first of all, by their lawyer, by their barrister or solicitor, and then they are cross-examined by the prosecution. But sometimes people don't want to give evidence or are advised not to. And again, there is a special warning that the judge will give the defendant in the presence of the jury and later will advise the jury about the consequences of not giving evidence.
And again, and that's interesting, because you say the judge will warn the accused. The person
well, yes,
that's being
in
accused.
In open court, the judge will say something along the lines of, this is the time when the process, and this is not exact by any means, but this is the time when the process would normally expect you to give evidence because it's your turn, and you will have been advised or you will have made a decision about whether you want to give evidence, what you're going to do. And the barrister or solicitor for the defendant might say, I am going to call my client, and off we go. Or they might say, we have made a decision, or a decision has been made, that we're not going to give evidence at this stage, or we're not going to give evidence, or this defendant isn't going to give evidence. They might call other evidence in the defense case from other people, or they might not. And so the judge then explains that there are circumstances in which he or she can later give the jury a warning, an adverse inference direction, as I say, about the consequences of not giving evidence, and that would take place during the course of the summing up. But he says, he or she says that to the defendant so that they understand the consequences of not giving evidence. And all of that takes place in as I say, virtually every case up and down the country. So again, yes, you have the right not to give evidence if you want, but there are consequences from that. And again, some people might feel that they're not particularly well equipped to give evidence. That they,
I mean, the courtroom's a very intimidating place. You know, I love being in a courtroom, but it is an intimidating place. And especially, you know, criminal trials with the jury, you've got 12 members of the public sitting there, you know, watching you or looking at you. And there's a lot going on. And I get it. I mean, will the jury automatically assume that you've done something wrong and you're hiding something? It largely depends on the details of the case. Is it in your favour to give evidence? Well, you know, if a judge is warning you of the consequences of not giving evidence, again, it's a very personal decision. Legal advice is very unique and specific to the situation that you're in. I would just say take your time and think about it very carefully.
Absolutely. I think as a general rule, I think that most people, and I've come to this conclusion over many years, I think that most defendants would think to themselves, look at it from the other way around. If I were a jury and somebody had been accused and here's all this evidence against them, would I not want to hear from them to answer the accusation, essentially? And I think the answer to that is yes. Now, of course, there are hundreds of variables and preponderables that go into that decision. I understand that. Also, a person's capacity to answer, a person's capacity to recollect, a person's ability to get a point across. I mean, even if you make it, and you're right, I mean, of itself, a courtroom is intimidating, but we try and make it less so if we can. And certainly for vulnerable people, we make it very much less awful for them if we can. There are many ways of doing that. But ultimately, if a person feels that they're not going to do their best and get their points across because of who they are or because of the circumstances, or it may be that their mind just goes blank when faced with a question, that then of course it's up to the barrister, and that's the skill hopefully that we have in teasing out from them every single thing that you think the jury want to hear. But I think as a general rule, as I say, giving evidence is probably the better choice, because at least, if nothing else, the jury will think, well, do you know what? At least this person has had the courage to stand up and say to us, well, it's all very well the prosecution saying all these terrible things about me, but here's the reason why I say I didn't do it. And I think that's a very powerful set of circumstances.
Yes.
And something that can sometimes of itself be the difference between someone being found guilty and not guilty.
Another great podcast, John Riley. Thank you so much for your time. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
And what I'll say to our listeners is don't forget to click and subscribe to our podcasts. And you can find us on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, LinkedIn and YouTube by searching Get Legally Speaking. Also visit our website at getlegallyspeaking.com. Thank you for listening. Empower yourself today with legal knowledge and follow us on Instagram, Twitter or Facebook to get access to jargon-free legal information in plain and simple English. Today's episode is supported by Red Bar Law, the go-to law firm for expert, efficient and fast legal assistance, all at a fixed cost. Go to our website at redbarlaw.com. Our episodes are free to access. However, if you feel that you would like to support the children's charity that we are raising money for, then head over to our Just Giving page at justgiving.com and search for Hattie Savari, where we are raising money for orphaned children at SOS Children's Villages, one of the worthiest children's charities. Donate as little as £1 for a great cause. Thank you. Empower yourself today and follow us on TikTok, Instagram, Facebook, YouTube and LinkedIn by searching Get Legally Speaking to get access to jargon-free legal information in plain and simple English. Today's episode is supported by Red Bar Law, the go-to law firm for expert, efficient and fast legal assistance, all at a fixed cost. Go to our website at redbarlaw.com. With over 3 million downloads and counting, do not miss out on learning more about a topic that interests you. Go over to our website at getlegallyspeaking.com and browse over 100 podcast episodes. Empower yourself today with legal knowledge and follow us on Instagram, Twitter or Facebook to get access to jargon-free legal information in plain and simple English. Today's episode is supported by Red Bar Law, the go-to law firm for expert, efficient and fast legal assistance, all at a fixed cost. Go to our website at redbarlaw.com